Lewis is a great writer, but he's not always absolutely and immediately accessible or understandable, and The Abolition of Man is one of his hardest books.
Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is celebrating 10 years of podcasting in 2021. I'm your host and the creator of the show, William O'Flaherty. I've written two books related to Lewis. Learn more details about them at the end of the show. On the podcast today is Dr. Michael Ward, who is no stranger to All About Jack. In fact, he was one of the earliest guests I had on when I began in 2011. He returns to tell us about a book he's written called After Humanity. It's designed to help you understand the abolition of man by C.S. Lewis. Welcome back to All About Jack, Michael.
Thank you, William. Good to be with you.
Well, now let's get started by acknowledging maybe the obvious here in a tongue-in-cheek way, and that is, you know, getting someone to read a book about another book is a daunting task. In fact, why is your book even necessary, considering Lewis is known for being such a great writer?
Lewis is a great writer, but he's not always absolutely and immediately accessible or understandable. And The Abolition of Man is one of his hardest books. Quite a lot of people find it very difficult. Even the word impenetrable has sometimes been used about it. And that's because it originated as a series of high-level philosophical lectures that he gave at one of the great universities of England, not at Oxford as it happens, but at Durham. And therefore he was operating in a top flight academic context, and he wasn't making things as simple and easy as he does, for instance, in Mere Christianity, which originated as broadcasts over the BBC. So The Abolition of Man needs a guide. At least a lot of people feel it needs a guide. I certainly feel it needs a guide, and I've studied Lewis, you know, for most of my working life. But there are many things about it which I myself find difficult, and I learned a lot in putting this book together. So that's one of the reasons why it's needed. And the other is that The Abolition of Man is a very important work amongst C.S. Lewis's books. It may be difficult, but that doesn't mean that it's not central to his output as a thinker and writer. He once said himself that it's almost my favourite among my books. Almost my favourite among my books. And, you know, he wrote a lot of books. Walter Hooper, who was his editor and biographer, describes The Abolition of Man as an all but indispensable introduction to the entire corpus of Lewis's output. And another scholar has called The Abolition of Man the linchpin of Lewis's thought. And I agree. I think The Abolition of Man is extremely important. And though it's difficult, we need to know about it. And so putting in a bit of effort and reading a guide to the book as well as the book itself, I think will pay dividends.
I find that your book definitely does, because I have definitely enjoyed it. And as people have seen The Abolition of Man, it is a very small book, but he compacts a lot of stuff. And so unpacking it or having a commentary, which you provide, and that's the obvious majority of your book. But one of the things I do like is that After Humanity is much more. You provide six short chapters before it. Why did you break it down this way, and give us a taste of some of what you share?
Yeah, that's right. About half the book, the second half of the book, is what I call a commentary and gloss, where I go through The Abolition of Man almost line by line, sometimes word by word, explaining various things that might not be immediately obvious. But I lead into that commentary and gloss with, six short chapters talking about, first of all, the reception that the book had or has had, both when it first came out and in the decades since. I look at the context in the intellectual scene of the time. I look at, I give an overview of the Abolition of Man, you know, just a summary, just to remind people what are the basic essentials of the book. I have a discussion about whether the book is really a religious or a Christian work of apologetics or not. And I argue that it is much more philosophical than theological. That's one of the things that sometimes confuses people about The Abolition of Man, and we could perhaps come back to that. I have a chapter about Lewis's own background, his own personal life, and what sort of man he had been before he wrote The Abolition of Man, why it came out of him at the time it did. And then the sixth of these introductory chapters is about the legacy of The Abolition of Man, what kind of impact it has had in philosophy and in the thought of other writers and thinkers. And then comes the commentary and gloss. And finally, there's a concluding chapter where I discuss The Abolition of Man under four headings: prophecy, poetry, participation, and power.
And within your book, you note how, and you've already mentioned Mere Christianity is one of the titles, That Hideous Strength is another that you underscore as something that can help people understand or appreciate The Abolition of Man better. But looking beyond this, although you can mention some other titles if you like, what would you say in terms of some of the shorter writings, his essays? Is there maybe a top five or so essays that you find especially useful to understanding The Abolition of Man?
Yes, there are, and I'll mention those in a moment, but just to reinforce the point you made, that the first four chapters of Mere Christianity are like a kind of distillation, a summary version, a more accessible, popularized version of The Abolition of Man. So if your listeners are a bit daunted, say, by The Abolition of Man, maybe they haven't read it themselves yet, or you know, find it extremely difficult, I suggest a very good way of limbering up for The Abolition of Man is just to reread those first four chapters of Mere Christianity, Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. It's essentially the same argument, but done much more easily and simply. And then That Hideous Strength, the third volume in his Ransom trilogy, Lewis himself said in the preface to That Hideous Strength that that it has behind it a serious point that he was making in The Abolition of Man. That Hideous Strength is really the fictional counterpart to The Abolition of Man. But then to answer your question about shorter works, essays and so on, that are especially useful for enhancing our understanding of The Abolition of Man, well, there's The Poison of Subjectivism. There's his essay On Ethics. Those are very much like, you know, shorter expressions of the same basic contention. Then very similar, but on slightly different frequency, there's his essay on the humanitarian theory of punishment, his essay Meditation in a Tool Shed, where he talks about the importance of looking along a beam of light, participating in a way of knowing. That theory of participation is very relevant to The Abolition of Man. And the fifth essay I would suggest that's useful is A Man or Rabbit? Man or Rabbit? That's an essay about morality, where Lewis says that morality is not the end of life. Morality is a kind of preparation for life. True morality, once you live a truly moral life, kind of vanishes. So his point about morality is not that we need to be terribly legalistic and conscientious all the time or scrupulous. You know, once we're living the good life, morals, you know, moral laws, moral duties, moral requirements, as it were, fade into the background. They just become natural. They become the way we wish to live and naturally do live. We no longer are a timid, ethical, conscientious rabbit worrying about whether we're doing the right thing or not. We become true human beings.
Well, as you note, chapter 7 is where you begin to give your commentary, or as you note, it's called a commentary and gloss. And you begin with the title and then the first lecture, Lewis entitled Men Without Chest. You can probably go ahead and include how you the clarification about the question of this being or not being a religious work and then why Lewis might have done it that way.
Yeah, so Men Without Chests is the first lecture. And the idea of the chest is something that needs quite a lot of explaining to newcomers. Lewis has a model of the human person divided into three: the head, the chest, and the belly. And in the head, we have rational thoughts. We are spiritual creatures. In the belly, we have passions and sensations. We are animals. But in the chest, we combine the two, The chest is the liaison officer between rational man and visceral man, he says. We are rational animals. That's the classic definition of what it is to be human. And the chest is the seat or the location of stable sentiments. We don't drive out our passions and our emotions that we have, that we share with our animal nature. But we need to control them. We need to stabilize them and make them just and civilized sentiments. And we do that by means of, practical reason. The head rules the belly through the chest, Lewis argues. And so his argument here is all very philosophical and indeed anthropological. It's not a specifically Christian argument. He's not arguing for Christianity. He's not even arguing for theism. He says in the course of The Abolition of Man, though I am myself a theist and indeed a Christian, I'm not attempting here any even indirect argument for theism. So he's setting his sights very low, not even an indirect argument for theism. All he's trying to do is define what it is to be human. And his answer is moral awareness, the ability to discern right and wrong and to distinguish might from right. That's what makes us human. That's a definition which all cultures, all civilizations across the world and down through history could ascribe to, which is why The Abolition of Man closes with an appendix of various moral rules. And under each heading of these eight moral rules that he lists, he includes citations from any number of different traditions around the world, Babylonian, Hindu, ancient Egyptian, Aboriginal Australian, Native American, Jewish, Christian, you name it, it's there. Because his point is not to defend specifically Christianity or theism, but just to define morality. What you might say, from a Christian point of view, is a definition of the image of God in us from the ethical point of view, the conscience, which indeed is to be found in all human beings. Like St. Paul says in the letter to the Romans, even the Gentiles outside the law are a law unto themselves because they have the law written in their hearts, and their hearts now acquit them and now condemn them. So there St. Paul is, basically giving the same argument that C.S. Lewis is giving, but within a biblical framework. Lewis's framework is much more purely philosophical.
Now, starting on page 119 of your book, and lasting just over 30 pages, you include a photo gallery that I really enjoyed. What can you describe that the reader can look forward to seeing in this part?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite bits about the whole book, actually. I was delighted that the publisher's Word on Fire Academic allowed me to put in all these pictures, many of them in glorious full color. And they include, lots of people and places and documents that help illuminate the abolition of man. I'll mention just three. One is Lewis's original blurb for the book. I found in the University of Durham archives, because it was at Durham that he gave these lectures, I found in his own handwriting a paragraph that he wrote for the purposes of publicizing and distilling the argument of the abolition of man. But it was never used, and nobody seems to have known about it. Not even the late, great Walter Hooper seems to have known about this. So I'm publishing it here for the first time. I got permission from the C.S. Lewis estate to include the original in his handwriting, and then there's a transcription for anybody who can't read his handwriting. So I'm really proud to include that. Another photograph I include is of Lewis in uniform when he was a soldier in the First World War. He was an officer in the British Army, and although this photograph has been published before, not many people have realised that it also includes Paddy Moore. And Paddy Moore, of course, was a fellow officer cadet with Lewis, and they shared a room in the billet, and that's where they first met. And that short friendship turned out to be crucial for Lewis's whole future, because after Paddy was killed, unfortunately, in the First World War, Lewis kept a promise that he'd made to Paddy and looked after Paddy's mother and sister for decades. So the whole course of Lewis's life was changed by that short friendship and Paddy's death. But it's relevant to the abolition of man, because in the abolition of man, Lewis argues that death for a good cause is the crucial test of the objectivity of value. And Lewis had lived this truth. He himself had very nearly been killed in the First World War, and he'd seen all sorts of friends of his and comrades of his killed, including this Paddy Moore. So having that little sort of biographical background detail in the photo gallery, I think, helps explain some of the personal import of his argument there. And then the third thing I'll mention, I was delighted about this, because a lot of emphasis is put upon Lewis's work at Magdalen College, Oxford, and then Magdalen College, Cambridge, where he finished his career. But not much attention is given to the college where he started out, University College, Oxford. That's where he was an undergraduate, and that's where he began his academic career. His first academic post was teaching philosophy at University College. And I found a portrait of three men who appointed C.S. Lewis to that first job that he had, the Master of University College and the two Fellows in Philosophy. They're pictured together in this portrait of the fellows of the college, and they all just happened to be next to each other, so I could detail out this particular portion of the portrait, so they're all very clear and visible. And that's just delightful to get the pictures of these three men that were, you know, they appointed Lewis to his first job. They haven't received the recognition that they deserve, but now you can see them.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I mean, many people don't consider that, photos in a book of this nature would be much of a benefit, but definitely I believe they are in what you present. Well, now, as you note, The Way is a more optimistic than the first or final lecture. What are some examples of the insights you provide from this part?
Yes, The Way is the title that Lewis gives to the second of the three lectures. So after Men Without Chests, we now have The Way. So he's moving from the negative to the more positive. And The Way is another term to describe this moral ecology, this fund of moral truths that is accessible to all human beings. Here in the title of the second chapter, he calls it The Way, but elsewhere in the book, he more usually calls it the Tao, a Chinese word taken from Confucian philosophy, which Lewis selects to emphasize the universality of this moral atmosphere or this moral ecology that he's describing. He's not choosing a term from the Christian tradition or from Western categories of thought. He deliberately goes all the way to China to talk about the Tao, to emphasize that what he's talking about is accessible to all human beings, not just to those who believe in God, let alone the Christian God. So The Way is, you know, this great fund or reservoir of moral truths, and it's that which he illustrates, as I mentioned, in the appendix at the end. And I think this is one of the more sort of thought-provoking aspects of the book, that we're endlessly told, aren't we, from every quarter that, oh, morality is just relative and what's true for you is true for you, but my truth is something quite different. But by emphasizing the universality of basic moral intuitions, Lewis is proving with sort of indisputable evidence that this is just not the case. Of course, there are differences between moral traditions, and different cultures and civilizations have emphasized different aspects of the moral law, but they've all accepted its objectivity. And the central core of human moral awareness is remarkably similar throughout time and across space, across the globe. So The Way is his introduction to that whole moral framework.
Given my specialty is misattributions and misquotations associated with Lewis, I was pleased to see you uncovered a few interesting items related to them. Two of them reveal Lewis wasn't perfect when quoting others. Can you tell us some about what you found?
Yes. Within The Abolition of Man, there are two examples of Lewis quoting inaccurately. He talks at one point about desert's vast futurity. And that's a quotation taken from the English metaphysical poet Andrew Marvell. He was working in the 17th century. Marvell wrote this poem to his coy mistress, which includes the lines, "But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity." So in the original, it's deserts of vast eternity, and Lewis misquotes that, makes it deserts of vast futurity. So he keeps the rhyme and the rhythm, but he gets the wrong word. And then later on in the book, he quotes the Roman satirist Juvenal. He was working in the first century AD. And what Juvenal had said was, "This I will, so I command, let my will take the place of reason," which in Latin is hoc volo sic ubio sit pro ratione voluntas. And, you know, Lewis, as a classicist, ought to have got this right. Those of us who haven't properly studied the classics would be, you know, struggling to get anything of this at all. But rather than hoc volo sic ubio, Lewis misquotes it, sic volo sic ubio. So tut, 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 Professor Lewis, you made a mistake there. So it's nice to find Lewis making little errors, because it reminds us that he's human. And indeed, one other example I've found in the course of my research into this book was that he sent a copy of The Abolition of Man to his former tutor, E.F. Carrot, one of these three men I was talking about earlier, who appointed him to his first job. He sent a copy to his old tutor to get the tutor's feedback, and Carrot sent the book back to Lewis with marginal comments and questions. And Carrot said about one particular line, "I don't understand this. Who are you talking about?" And in Lewis's marginal response, Lewis says, "It's a bad sentence, I admit." And it's nice to find Lewis, you know, in pupillary mode, humbly confessing to his old teacher that he'd been less than stylistically perfect. Because, yeah, Lewis is generally a very lucid writer and a very accurate writer on the whole, but he did have his errors. And then one other thing that I mentioned which is in your wheelhouse regarding misattributions. We've already talked about his experience in the First World War when he was nearly killed. When he was 20, that happened. And I was aware that there was this quotation out there. If you want to understand a famous figure from the past, ask yourself what was going on in his life when he was 20. And I did a lot of searching for the correct attribution of this line. Nearly everywhere on the internet, it's attributed to Napoleon Bonaparte. But eventually I tracked down the real origin, and it's a Victorian historian called G.M. Young. He's the one who said it, but nobody knows about G.M. Young. So the quotation just gets attached to someone that you think, oh, it could plausibly have been said by X. And as you know very well, better than anybody, all sorts of things are plausibly attributed to C.S. Lewis, because people just can't remember who it was who actually said the thing in question.
Well, now that's really interesting about your find about the quote falsely credited to Napoleon, along with finding a couple places where Lewis wasn't best at remembering a quote, given there are quite a few expressions with Lewis's name on that he didn't write. Now then, continuing with the chapter 7, the last lecture is called simply The Abolition of Man. Go ahead and provide a few samples of some of the intriguing information that you share.
Yes, so we're back to a more negative register in this third lecture. Men without chests was negative, the way was a bit more positive, and now we're back to doom and gloom as Lewis predicts and forecasts what the likely outcome is if we adopt a subjectivist attitude in ethics. And we're going to result in our own destruction as a species. We will no longer be men, we will be artifacts, he says. We will be, you know, made thus and thus by our conditioners, those who have power over us. And indeed, you know, it's not just those who have power over us, it is we who have power over ourselves. We can begin to make ourselves into artifacts if we choose. And that's what brings about the abolition of man. So the final line of of Lewis's book is to see through all things is the same as not to see. In other words, we can make ourselves morally blind. We can begin to see through first principles of this moral framework which within which we find ourselves. We can begin to suppose that these things are transparent. We can just see through them. But if everything is transparent, everything is invisible, and a wholly invisible world is a world in which everybody is effectively blind. So it's this willful self-blinding that he's describing in this third chapter, and that's what I unpick line by line, paragraph by paragraph. I think myself that this last lecture is the weakest bit of the book. It's unusual to find Lewis being unclear, but there are some moments of genuine obscurity. It's not just it's difficult, it's actually badly written in places here and there. You know, just odd sentences. The whole book is a classic work, brilliant work, but even Lewis stumbles occasionally. So clarifying these difficult moments, I think, well, it was very helpful to me. And so I hope it will be helpful to other people. I ought to add, I mean, that I'm no philosopher myself. I'm a literary critic and a theologian, and I'm operating here slightly outside my comfort zone because I've not studied philosophy. I don't teach philosophy. But Lewis, of course, had both studied it and taught it. But I hope that that's all to the good in my guide, because it means that I don't come to The Abolition of Man assuming that anything is going to be particularly difficult or particularly easy. I assume that it's all difficult. and therefore, yeah. I don't underestimate how hard people will find it.
Yeah, and in fact, I don't know if someone else has thought of this before, but... You know, since Lewis died, not necessarily prematurely, but if he had lived several more years and had revisited some of his works and potentially revised them, The Abolition of Man probably could have been one that, looking back, you know, 20 plus years afterwards, he may have come to the same thoughts in terms of, yeah, that third one didn't say it enough. Let me add to it. But then because he didn't, then we have a book like yours, which probably helps clarify even things more than what he might have necessarily been aware of needing clarifying, because he would assume that people would know some of the various things that now people today probably do not. Now, you finish the main part of your book with a conclusion, and then you include questions for discussion. Why did you believe these parts were necessary, and share some content from each?
Yes, I close the book with 33 questions for discussion, because I'm assuming, or at any rate, I'm hoping that quite a lot of readers will want to use my guide as a guide for a group discussion, or maybe in a classroom setting or a church group or whatever. So I thought it would be helpful if I gave at least some examples of questions. Of course, they're not exhaustive, and people can come up with their own questions, but that's one of the ways in which I'm trying to serve the reader. But, and before we get to the questions for discussion, there is, as you say, a concluding chapter when I just, as it were, try to sum up the main things we've learned about The Abolition of Man and four useful ways of considering it. And I have these four headings all beginning conveniently with the same letter. Prophecy, poetry, participation, power. And well, I could say a lot about all those things, but why not talk about poetry? Because obviously the Abolition of Man is not written in verse. It's not poetic in that sense, but it's poetic in two other senses, I think. One is that it's stylistically brilliant. I mean, for all that there are moments of obscurity, it's generally a magnificent piece of rhetoric. Lewis makes what would otherwise be a very abstract argument concrete with well-chosen analogies and similes and metaphors. He's just a brilliant stylist. He knows how to make things engaging and involving and imaginable. So that's what I mean by poetry in one sense. And in the other sense, it's poetic because, as Lewis's fellow Irishman W.B. Yeats, the great poet, said, We make out of the quarrel with others rhetoric, but of the quarrel with ourselves poetry. We make out of the quarrel with others rhetoric, but out of the quarrel with ourselves poetry. And I think Lewis had quarreled with himself about subjectivism. What I mean is, in his early years, in his teens and in his 20s, he had felt the lure, he'd felt the temptation of subjectivism. He talks about his own various tendencies in the subjectivist direction in Surprised by Joy and elsewhere. And he'd wrestled with that temptation and had come out the other side. He defeated this philosophical enemy. But having defeated it, he knew its strength. He knew the moves that you needed to make in order to defeat it. And he was anxious to share that learning that he'd come to in his own personal experience. So he had quarreled with himself, and as a result, he's producing poetry. He's producing something which is not just rhetoric. He's not just shouting down an opposition. He's not just, you know, point scoring. It's not just polemic. No, it's actually a hard-won private battle that he's talking about. I mean, not in so many terms, of course, but that, I think, helps explain why The Abolition of Man has such an involving heft to it. We feel that something really important is being expressed because it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, most definitely. Yeah, well, that's very good that you help readers of The Abolition of Man to understand it more clearly with the contents of your book, and then you wrap it up to make sure that the those themes that you bring out with those 4 points that people understand the book better. Well, now let's go ahead and close then, though, by having you give a final summary of why someone who would want to read your book, again, it's called After Humanity, and where they can get it, as well as where they can learn more about you online.
Yeah, well, just to summarize why someone would want to read After Humanity, to repeat what we said earlier, Lewis himself regarded it as almost his favorite book, and other scholars have described it as indispensable, a linchpin. So a lot of, you know, your listeners are naturally keen C.S. Lewis enthusiasts. And if you want to be a real scholar of C.S. Lewis or you know, just have a proper complete grasp, get your arms around him generally, you need to grapple with The Abolition of Man. But it's difficult. And so having a guide is hopefully going to be of use to you. It certainly was of use to me in producing it. I learned a lot, as I said. Those are some reasons why people would want to read the book. And hopefully, you know, the book itself is not just helpful, but enjoyable in its own right. We talked about, you know, one of the most enjoyable aspects being the pictures. And I certainly love the photo gallery myself. I'm as proud as punch about much of that. But about a lot of the findings I unearthed, I'm pleased to have, you know, done this archaeological dig. And sometimes it's actually rather funny, the sort of stuff I turned up, because, you know, behind the ostensible target of The Abolition of Man, who are Gaius and Titius, you know, Lewis gives them pseudonyms, but they were real people in real life, Alec King and Martin Ketley, and I've got photographs of them in the book. But behind them are two more significant thinkers, A.J. Ayer and I.A. Richards. And with both Richards and Ayer, I came across two really juicy and amusing little interactions between Lewis and those two men, because he knew them in real life. He interacted with them and joked about them. And you don't expect philosophy necessarily to be funny or to be, you know, personally involving, but it actually is. So those are some of the reasons why people would want to read the book. And where can they get it? wordonfire.org/humanity. So Word on Fire is the publisher. The imprint is Word on Fire Academic. It's a new line of academic books that Word on Fire are bringing out. And so go to the wordonfire.org/humanity website to find out how to get the book. And if you want to learn about me, specifically, my website is michaelward.net.
All right, and we encourage people to check that out. And I'll have links in the show notes for all the things that Michael's talked about, as well as other times that he's been on the program. There's some other book, something about Narnia and the planet that people may have heard. They can be sure to check that out if they haven't heard about that already. Well, Michael, thanks again for being on All About Jack.
My pleasure, William. Thank you. Further up and further in, I say.
Thank you, the listener, for your interest in this episode of All About Jack. All About Jack is a feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of the show. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including material about quotations credited to Lewis that he may not have written. I also have a YouTube channel that was previously called 90 Seconds to Knowing C.S. Lewis, but I frequently post material longer than that, so it's now called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. You'll also find links in the show notes to other podcasts Michael has been on, as well as links to copies of books he has written. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.